All right, we're live. Welcome to 2017, Toby.
It's going to be a good one.
I hope so. How was your winter break?
Spent a lot of time refusing to read.
Oh, yeah? What did you refuse to read?
Most everything.
I'm Andrew Marzoni.
I'm Toby Wilson Bates.
And this is The Office Hour. Good to see you, Toby. It's been a while.
It is. You look really dapper.
Oh, thanks. I got a haircut. And you grew, like, a bigger beard than you had before.
And I had the barber actually shape it the other day. I realized the natural thing would only allow me to grow the beard so far before I just got disgusted and destroyed it all.
Uh-huh.
But if you shape it,
or rather
have a professional shape it, you can go bigger without looking disgusting.
Yeah, that's true.
Don't worry, I'm only 32 and I've discovered this.
Amazing. So what we are here to talk about today is a rather now old, I guess, 5-month-old piece from the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is called On Not Reading... by Amy Hungerford, who teaches at Yale, I believe. The reason that I'll just give you a little background, I heard about this article when I went to the MLA convention a couple of weeks ago. I went to a panel that was about David Foster Wallace's novel Infinite Jest, which turned 20 last year. So it was sort of thinking about the novel at 20 years old. She writes in this article about refusing to read the work of David Foster Wallace, primarily based on the allegations in D.T. Max's biography, which, as far as I know, are totally true, that, you know, he was kind of a misogynist.
But it's worth pausing to say that while Infinite Jest is the sacred cow that she's intent on killing in this article, the larger statement is about rejecting certain kinds of cultural filters that select your reading for you. Because there's so much stuff that's produced, are you just going to let the Times Literary Supplement decide which books you read and this kind of thing?
Right, absolutely. And I think what she is targeting is this attitude that I think is very prevalent, that I was, you know, sort of introduced to my first year of graduate school, like when I was doing my MA, one of my professors told the class, you know, that part of being in the profession is being comfortable pretending to have read things. Because, you know, when it comes down to it, if you're an academic, you're never going to ever have read everything that you should because you just can't, right? And so a lot of succeeding in the profession requires eliding that fact, either by denying that you haven't read things or by just sort of, like, you know, tacitly slipping by as though you had.
And that's a little bit of a, I don't know, evil-sounding version of what I tend to think about. There's this term, cultural capital.
Right.
It's this thing that hypothetically we accrue, especially when you read great works of literature, and then you're able to appear really knowledgeable, like you have this kind of cultural currency. And obviously you haven't read everything. Nobody has since Milton, or maybe not even him. But in order to have cultural capital, it's almost like having a credit card. You don't have that money, but you can kind of pretend you have it. And then you can still buy things. So maybe you haven't read Tristram Shandy, but you kind of have enough constellations of pieces of information that you can have an intellectual conversation about Lawrence Stern and postmodernism or something like that.
Absolutely. And I'll give you a great example. I have never read nor seen any of the Harry Potter books or films before. And there's a really... This was mostly motivated out of a kind of iconoclasm as a 20-something that just turned into, like, eventually no longer consciously choosing not to read them or see them, but just, like, it just passed me by. And I think that Chuck Klosterman wrote an essay about this, about how, like, his career as a cultural critic would ultimately no longer be accessible to him because he let Harry Potter go over his head. But I find that, I am still able to have a debate about which of my friends is, like, a Gryffindor or a Ravenclaw or a Hufflepuff or whatever, despite not having any, like, firsthand access to what those things mean, because they have trickled down into the culture, like, to a huge extent.
And there are some massive and glaring flaws with Amy Hungerford's arguments. And this is a nice one that I hadn't even thought about. The fact that these texts and cultural capital is much more ubiquitous than I think she points towards. That you don't have to have read Infinite Jest to sort of be affected by some of the themes that kind of float around in culture. A great example of this, I'm teaching Frankenstein right now. Frankenstein's biggest print run, I think, was about 500 copies.
Oh, wow.
Which, you know, it sold out. It sold out, I think, three runs of about that many copies, which was fine. That was, like, relatively successful during the period. But that didn't mean it was super well known. And actually, most people heard about Frankenstein because theater adaptations at the time, where they stole the idea freely because there was no copyright law about changing from text into performance. Nor were they really able to police that. So most people knew about Frankenstein because of the sort of idea as it permutated in culture, not because people were necessarily sitting down and reading the book. So refusing to read the book isn't the same thing as, like, not interacting with the idea.
Have you ever refused to read anything in the sense that Amy Hungerford is talking about? Like, be it for, you know, political or protest reasons or otherwise?
I mean, honestly, I would say 100% of my refusing to read things is just because you have to economize time.
Absolutely.
And a lot of my reading, conversely, and I think she kind of misses this somewhere in there, has to do with how the canon operates. So there's this thing, the literary canon, the books that you've heard about, or the authors that you've heard about, someone like Shakespeare. And it actually serves a lot of different purposes. For one thing, they're the kind of books that you hear about on panels. They're the kind of books that you're asked questions about in job interviews. They're the kind of books that your students come to class expecting to learn about, because this is where cultural capital lies. And you can argue, well, most of these books are by these, you know, upper class or upper middle class
dead white men.
Yeah, dead white men. And that's certainly true for a range of cultural and economic reasons. However, these works now serve a very different purpose in a lot of different ways and get kind of reused and recycled by all different facets of society in the way that you can imagine Shakespeare being done by so many different people for so many different reasons. And so it's a little disingenuous for a Yale professor to be like, well, I choose not to read this. And you're like, you're a Yale professor. No one's going to ask you now in a job interview about Tristram Shandy. You don't need to kind of cover your ass by reading the canonical texts of your field.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's perhaps unfair to reduce it to this, but this is what was done on this Infinite Jest panel I went to. The question there is, like, how can you make an intellectual argument about a book which you haven't read?
Yeah. Which people do a lot. It's worth saying to some degree or another, or they've read the book so long ago that it's no longer necessarily very present to them.
Absolutely. And I mean, you ultimately, especially if you are, like we are, you know, a teacher of writing, you end up having to resort to shortcuts, right? Like if you're trying to give your students some sort of sense of literary history or something like that, there are ultimately going to be steps along the way that you don't really have very much or any firsthand experience with, that you sort of have to rely on, you know, like another critic's take on it or something like that. And that doesn't, to me, seem intellectually dishonest, but I think that trying to illustrate a text as not being worthy of reading, even just personally, from the position of an intellectual, seems to me like nonsense.
Yeah, but it's worth saying that I think she's actually bringing up, I think, an extremely, extremely important topic, and I think she says a lot of things really well in this article, so I am piling on a bit onto this, but I actually really love that she wrote this. I think polemics like this are really good for getting conversations started. And it's like, how do you start this conversation properly and in a way that is, I mean, to for lack of a better term, is kind of clickbait in the way that it can reach a large enough audience. So I think the refusing to read, it's nice, it's fun to kind of begin with, I refuse to read something. I feel like the subtitle should be kind of like, we can't do it. It's right. Sort of like a necessary element of our field that we only have so many hours in the day, we have a lot of different obligations, and we need to make these critical decisions all the time.
And to her credit, like, she makes that point in the article.
Exactly.
Right? Is that this is a thing that we are, if you read anything, that the process of reading a book is also the process of not reading, you know, infinity other books because you're reading this one instead.
Yeah, and for me, it kind of gets at, because one of the points that she makes is that she dislikes the sort of filters that other institutions, like the review of books, put onto books so that somebody else kind of holds the gate keys to who gets to count as culture and this sort of stuff. But there isn't a great solution. I mean, what media reaches enough people to make them aware of a text, and then also reaches those people with a kind of critical observation? I mean, do we want to do a sort of Rotten Tomatoes for literature? And if so, like, who gets to have the say? Is it that she wants Yale professors, like herself, to be the ones who have the final say on whether or not people should spend their time reading Infinite Jest? This is like saying, well, the Washington Post and the New York Times aren't perfect. Let's just get rid of them and look at, you know, whatever, at Twitter posts.
Right. Exactly.
You know, it's like, what's the arbiter that you want? We have the best things that we have. You're not offering an alternative. You're just offering a critique of the current status quo.
And, I mean, grounding it in Infinite Jest, which is, I guess, canonical.
That was a weird choice for me. Because I feel like she could have gone Tristram Shandy or David Copperfield or, I don't know, Catcher in the Rye. I feel like just page numbers was a big thing for her. And it's worth saying, just to grab a sub point, she throws Franco Moretti out as this kind of distant reading paragon. You say, okay, well, Franco Moretti is giving us a way to deal with large bodies of text without actually needing to put our eyes on every page of a text. And I'd say two things. One, Franco Moretti does some powerful stuff. He's also potentially a bit of a snake oil salesman.
Mm-hmm.
Two, Franco Moretti's dealing with a period in history, the 18th and 19th century, where novels were written serially. So we might see that novel as a 1,000-page novel, but everybody reading that novel in the period was reading that as, like, 20 pages at a time.
Absolutely.
Over years. Yeah. It would be like saying, oh, well, all shows ever are just Netflix binge-watching shows. Therefore, we should only deal with the show if we can watch, you know, 30 hours of show at one time.
Right. And I think that by focusing so much on a novel that is only 20 years old, hints to me that this is more of a complaint about canon formation and who gets to decide what should be considered an important novel rather than whether or not a given text is actually worth reading. One of the points she makes about Infinite Jest, just to clarify for those who haven't read the article, though all of you should, Infinite Jest is 1,000 pages long, mm-hmm. right? And part of the argument that Huckerford makes is that by choosing to read Infinite Jest, she would be basically giving a month of her reading life away to David Foster Wallace. Which I should point out, maybe I'm a slow reader. I don't think it. I am. It took me about 4 or 5 months to read Infinite Jest and not just one. But anyway, the idea being that there's a certain kind of arrogance or presumptuousness on the part of a novel such as Infinite Jest, that by virtue of being 1,000 pages long, it is literally a heavy weight text, right? And is thus fast-tracked to canonical status, right? Because it's a 1,000-page novel. hearing a Yale professor complain about a text being fast-tracked to canonical status by virtue of the fact that it drew the attention of the people based on its length and perhaps the author's biography, you know, David Foster Wallace committed suicide, which definitely lends a certain mythos to his oeuvre.
To stand a little bit on her behalf, part of the difficulty is that, let's say you're a professor at a community college or an adjunct or something like this, you don't necessarily have the time or standing to make this argument. In all likelihood, you're having to read and write on more canonical texts to try to get published. And she makes this point in the article that there's a way in which this is sort of recursive. The system feeds into itself. And so she is both sort of hypocritical in having this position, but also maybe the only person who can have this position because she has the sort of intellectual mobility and freedom to stand up and, like, try to change the system from sort of on top of it.
Which begs the question, and I mean, you did mention the word clickbait, and we're now in the era of fake news, and we're in an era in which a lot of scholars are calling for more public-facing scholarship, which a Chronicle editorial seems to fit the bill. My question, and we don't have to answer this, but my question would be whether this kind of argument would hold up as a more rigorously intensive scholarly perspective rather than a public-facing piece of perhaps clickbait.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, it's meant to be polemic, but it kind of falls apart in a lot of ways. As I said, just for me, as someone who studies the 19th century, she has a very sort of jejune understanding of how only now in contemporary literature do we have the problem of too much writing and cultural institutions deciding what's going
to...
If you look at the 18th and 19th century, this was huge. Samuel Johnson, this is a great example of this. Samuel Johnson wrote this really popular book called The Dictionary. Still, people still read that thing sometimes when they look for the meanings of words, that kind of thing. Anyway, Samuel Johnson does this thing. He's, you know, the lives of the poets. He does introductions to all the greatest poets, you know, Milton, Shakespeare, poets, playwrights, whatever, all this kind of stuff. Novelists weren't meaningful back then. And the sense is that Samuel Johnson, kind of standing on top of the intellectual world at the time, has selected the canon, and he's going to introduce them all to you. A lot of people go back and quote Samuel Johnson because he says brilliant things about all kinds of stuff. The texts that he chose were actually just the texts that that publisher had copyright for. And that's, like, that's all it was.
Right.
That, like, they could print this thing for free because they owned the rights to those texts. Samuel Johnson was the smartest guy in the room. They got him to do that. He made an explanation for why it worked. It's always been a problem that cultural institutions of corporations of different sizes control what gets to count as literature in one way or another. That is a problem that's baked into the discipline. It's not something that, like, now we get to say, wait a second, like, now this problem has arrived. Look how Franco Moretti solves this in the 19th and 18th century. Like, no, Franco Moretti is looking at exactly the same, not maybe not exactly the same, but, like, a similar set of the same compromises made over the history of literature. This isn't, like, a new thing.
So, I mean, to close things out for this week, is there, like, a book that you have for reasons no matter how trivial, like, just refuse to read in your life of reading? Not just by simple omission, but just, like, I don't want to read that.
Oh, I had one on the tip of my tongue, and I can't remember.
I'll give you an example. I had a Shakespeare professor in college, and I always thought this was beautiful and poetic. He was a Shakespeare scholar, who still is. We asked him one time, you know, like, you've read everything Shakespeare wrote, like, obviously. And he said, no, actually, there's one play that he had very consciously decided to not read, so that when he, like, retires, he can, like, experience the joy of reading a Shakespeare play one more time in his life. So that's not really a refusal to read so much as it is, like, a deferral. But is there anything that you've just chosen not to read, or not now?
It's, the title is escaping me, as is the entire text of the book. I just remember at some point my mom gave me a book, and I was like, I'm not reading this. This is a book from Mom. And I read it years later, and it was fantastic. But I'm totally blanking on it right now.
For me, it's Ayn Rand.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no one should do that anyway.
Yeah, right? Right?
We get the point.
Maybe we should write a chronicle piece about,
about refusing to read
Ayn Rand. Yeah, that'd be good.
Just a chronicle piece about refusing to read books that we wouldn't read anyway.
Yeah, it could be a series. I'm gonna pitch it to them. Like, I'm gonna, this week I'm refusing to, the books that, yeah, like, five books I'm refusing to read.
But this is a nice, this is actually a nice argument insofar as it's like, we've decided not to read these books just based on knowing what we know about them, and that's enough for us.
Right, exactly. Which sort of validates her point, in a way.
Ugh, she's won in the end.
Oh, God.
The Office Hour is produced by Andrew Marzoni and Tobias Wilson-Bates, Burton Fellows in the Writing and Communication Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. To find out more about the topics discussed, see our page at textile.lmc.gatech.edu. Thanks for listening! Don't know what a